This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates national average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
Support for the Memory Palace comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting your time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/memory. That's odoo.com/memory. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. Hers was no less of a leap, no less of a journey into the unknown. She and her husband were both from Arkansas, high school sweethearts who got hitched right before he shipped out. And when Oscar Lee Oliver set out to sea in the belly of a submarine, Betty Lou Oliver left home for the first time too. She would await his return in New York, which was unheard of for folks in her town. But this was 1944, when the world had seemed to shudder and uprooted lives and scattered them to places on the globe that people never imagined they would be. Had husbands in metal tubes pushing blindly through the black depths of the Pacific. And so she came to Manhattan at 19 years old. Small town girl in the big city. The lights, the crowds, the cabs, the subways, the usual. One of those experiences that is entirely cliched, unless you are the one inside it. And where should Betty Lou Oliver of Fort Smith, Arkansas, fresh off the bus, suitcase in hand, pink hat box under her arm, looking up, awestruck, fine work. Why, the Empire State Building. She became an elevator operator. Though at the time, in that skyscraper, with all of its state-of-the-art gleam and shine worthy of the world's tallest building, the job was almost vestigial. Her Otis elevator barely needed an operator. It had automatic doors. It stopped precisely at each floor, didn't require artful speed control or finessing it just so that the floor of the car aligned perfectly with the threshold, as with earlier models. It didn't even need someone to push the buttons. Betty Lou's ran as an express elevator from the ground to the 66th floor, and then became a local, stopping at each of the next floors in succession until the 80th, where she would then, and only then, push a lever and head back down. She made $35 a week, which felt like a bundle for the daughter of a coal miner. Working in tight spaces apparently ran in the family. And that was the job. Make the elevator go up, make the elevator go down, and smile. Make small talk with the folks on their way up or down. Probably answer questions about her accent. Maybe share news of her husband. Out there spending his war in a metal chamber, moving through three-dimensional space in the open ocean, as she spent hers in another, tracing and retracing the same vertical plane. That was her life for a year and a half, biding her time in a box, a few feet by a few feet, waiting for her husband's safe return and thinking about the future they'd build together when they were reunited in Fort Smith. And when Oliver wrote to say he was back stateside and regaining his land legs on a troop train homeward bound, Betty Lou put in her notice. Her last week of work was the last week of July 1945. She had just turned 20. The war in Europe was over. The war in the Pacific was about to be, though she couldn't know that, of course. But she knew her husband's was over. And he was safe. And those last days before she could hop the bus back home must have dragged. How many times a day did she check her watch? Did she let herself? Did she need to at all? Maybe she measured her days in that box and trips up and down, or by the color of whatever sunlight filtered into the hallway, caught in glimpses between the closing doors. Her last day of work was a Saturday, the 28th. So it was slow, relatively. But hopefully there were some familiar faces to share her excitement, to say her goodbyes on this, her last New York day. That last day of that time in her life that she spent in a box, in a tube, in the tallest building in the world, when the world seemed... Then all was noise. A tearing, a thundering, a smashing, Those were the only words that came to her to describe a sound she had never heard. It was above her, then all around her. She was between the 79th and 80th floors, having just dropped off her passengers, having pushed the lever to head back down. Now she was alone. Now the cabin was shuddering. Now something metal tore through the top of the car. Now black oil rained. It was hot, as though hell itself, she thought, had fallen down upon her. She tried to scream, but who could hear her? She couldn't hear herself. And then the box started to fall and fall and fall and fall, and all she could do was make herself small, crouch at the base of the wall, and wait to crash, and wait to die. She woke up with the priest above her, administering the Catholic prayers of last rites for the dying. She managed to tell him that she wasn't Catholic, and that she wasn't dying, though she couldn't really be sure about that last part. She passed out again, from the pain and the shock of having fallen 1,000 feet. No one had ever survived a 1,000-foot fall in an elevator before. Not that anyone ever had opportunity to try. Elisha Otis didn't invent modern life by inventing the elevator. He invented modern life by making sure elevators don't fall. At least not too far. With his safety brake that would stop one mid-plummet. Unless, it seems, that brake were destroyed. When the engine of an airplane, a B-25D bomber, flown by a veteran pilot just back from the European theater, who got cocky one morning and ignored warnings of dense fog blanketing the Empire State Building, flew out of that airplane when it crashed into the side of the tower just above the car where Betty Lou Oliver spent her days. And that flying engine tore through that car and destroyed the brake and severed the cables that would typically hoist and lower the box when Betty Lou pushed her lever, and so the car fell and fell and fell and fell, and Betty Lou fell and fell and fell and fell with it, not knowing any of this. Not knowing why she was falling and falling and falling and falling, just that she was most certainly going to die. And she wouldn't find out until later. In the hospital room she would stay in for 4 months, recovering from burns and a broken hip and a broken back and a broken neck. When someone explained it all, about the plane and about how she shouldn't be alive, except that all of that cable, 1,000 feet of it and more, tumbled with her when it snapped and spiraled down and landed in a coil, a kind of spring that softened the blow, relatively. And so she was able to see her husband again, and was able, after her months in the hospital, to take a trip back up an Empire State Building elevator, still on crutches but with a big smile for the cameras. The cameras would find her again at Christmas later that year. You can see her in front of her tree, in her and Oscar's living room in Arkansas, wrapped presents on her lap, crutches laid beside her like some post-war Tiny Tim. And in the summer of 46, as she and Oscar welcomed their first child, feel-good stories about a woman getting back on her feet that were perfect for a nation getting back on its own and figuring out what life would be like after everything it had been through. This episode of the Memory Palace is produced by me, Nate DeMeo, with research assistance from Eliza McGraw and engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert. The show is a proud member of Radiotopia, a podcast network from PRX. We get ad serving technology from AdZerk. Our ad music comes from JD Sampson. Now and again, I'd like to tell you about other Radiotopia shows. Today, it is Love and Radio, which just started its 7th season of remarkable storytelling about lives you just don't hear about anywhere else. This season, they are telling stories that explore where the individual ends and the collective begins, with tales of cults and religions and political parties and on, tales that dive deep into the consequences of belonging to a group. all done with Love and Radio's signature bravery and impeccable, unimpeachable production. Check it and the other Radiotopia shows out at radiotopia.fm. And finally, if you happen to be in Geelong, Australia, down Melbourne way, I will be there doing an event with the folks at the Wheeler Center on June 13th. You can find information at thememorypalace.us/events. And that will be it for live shows for the summer, but I'm planning on doing a number of shows this fall and winter. Just kind of mapping it out right now. Maybe I'll come to your town. So watch this space and thememorypalace.us and at the Memory Palace on Twitter and Facebook for updates. Talk to you guys again.
Radiotopia.